With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hey, stick around to the end of today's episode to hear the trailer of Between the Lines, The Athletic's newest narrative podcast documenting the intersection of race and football, coming to the Athletic Football Show feed on February 14th.
Hello, this is a special episode of the Athletic NBA Show, here to talk about Kyrie Irving and his trade to the Dallas Mavericks from a media member's perspective. I'm Tim Cato. I'm the Dallas Mavericks beat writer for The Athletic, and we've got Alex Schiffer, who covers the Brooklyn Nets, also for The Athletic, as you can probably guess here. And we're just going to go through the trade. You've probably heard a half dozen, you know, maybe two dozen podcasts already breaking down every specific dynamic of Kyrie Irving going to the Dallas Mavericks from Brooklyn. What we're going to do is go through it from our perspective, how we handle the news, how we approach, you know, even, you know, the hours after Kyrie is traded to the Mavericks, what that means for both teams, and how we go about figuring out what the motive is and what the meaning behind these moves are. Also, I just absolutely need Alex to tell me what the hell it's like trying to cover Kyrie Irving. I need some tips. I need some advice. Alex, how are you?
I'm good, man. It's weird. I feel like there's like the forecast had a storm a couple days ago and there's another one to come, and this is like the sunny day, but you never know when the clouds are going to come in, just because there's still trade rumors swirling around the Nets and I'm fully prepared. It's funny, when our producer sent me the Zoom link, I thought for a minute another trade had went down and there's another notification. So I feel like I'm not fully recovered from this weekend.
We are absolutely in the eye of trade deadline week, and I think we're grateful for that. How did you actually receive the news on Sunday? You know, which notification came across, and what's the first thing that goes through your brain? Not just about the deal, but what about your life is about to become for the next, what, 4 hours, 8 hours, the next week?
Yeah, so I was at the Seton Hall DePaul College basketball game, which is about, you know, a half hour from my house, and I had always had reservations about going to said game with family friends, because the Nets are in the midst of a back-to-back when we're recording this, and had a game the night before, so it's like four games in 4 days, and but I was being a good trooper. That being said, I can't tell you anything about the game because I'm on my phone the whole time working, you know, different angles as to who's hearing what, when it's coming in. And, you know, I had a couple people from different avenues, you know, some in the world of basketball. It's funny, actually, that one of the people who got me the tickets for the game actually heard that Dallas was going to be the destination. So, you know, you're working out the scenarios in your head of, all right, well, the Suns offered Chris Paul and Jay Crowder. What does that look like for the Nets? You know, who do the Mavericks have? You know, I never really fully believed the Lakers, just because you can't have Russell Westbrook and Ben Simmons, arguably two of the worst contracts in the league with similar games and holes in their game, you know, on the same roster with that luxury tax bill. So I never really took the Lakers seriously. I also never fully believed the Mavericks, just because you look at who they have in-house. Spencer Dinwiddie, now back with the Nets as a result of the trade. Matt Riccardi in the front office. Andrew Baker, I believe, is the front office member, who's another Nets alum. I was going to say Andrew Smith for some reason. I don't know an Andrew Smith. I don't know where I got that from. And, of course, Theo Pinson. You know, Jared Dudley's also a Nets alum from right before the Stars came, Kyrie and Kevin. So the common sense to me was kind of leaning toward Phoenix, just because I felt like the Mavericks had so many people in-house who could give them a firsthand experience of what the Kyrie Irving era in Brooklyn was like, to where they wouldn't maybe go through with it. That being said, the voices of Luka Doncic, Jason Kidd, Nico Harrison, you know, all those guys have much more pull than the people I just mentioned. So, you know, the whole afternoon I was thinking it was going to be Phoenix or Dallas, and then, you know, they started to get some late traction for Dallas. As we were about 10 minutes from my house coming back from the game, we ran in and picked up a pizza. I grabbed like three slices. I went to my room and I did not emerge for hours later while working the story. So that was my Sunday. And really everything since has been kind of a follow-up to that. What about you?
Yeah, I was on the phone with my dad, you know, a really high level, a high level source. And I saw the, I see the tweet come down, you know, the notification pop in there. And, you know, I grew up religious and, you know, even though, you know, got a good relationship with my families, I, you know, out of respect, you know, I just don't usually curse around them. So I remember saying, apologies for what I'm about to say, but holy shit, we can curse on this podcast. I do it on mine. It's allowed. And so it's even more allowed than being on a phone call with your dad. But that was my reaction to it. I then told him, I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to hang up. And you know, he understands my job and everything there is to it. And Schiffer, you're right. You know, we kind of walked through the idea. You know, like instantly, you know, we have an idea of you know, all the key factors and decision makers and influences. But I think there is some level of like all of those things swirling around and the hours afterwards, you know, maybe the first hour is like identifying all of them. And then I found that the next hour was putting them into a, you know, more of a coherent like structure and order. I had to organize all of these different things that I felt were impacting and had caused this deal to happen. And only then could I go from there and actually write what I'd ended up writing about the team's motivations. You know, and that, you know, took from, you know, like 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Central. So it definitely changed my Sunday. I'll say that for sure.
Yes.
So I am now with me.
Go ahead.
We are indeed. We are indeed going to welcome someone. And this is important because I am a media member who now is going to have to cover Kyrie Irving. Alex, you have done this a little bit before. Jay King has also done this. And Jay King just popped on. He's our Boston Celtics beat writer for The Athletic. What's up, Jay?
Hey.
Not much, fellas. How's it going?
Ooh.
Hey, good luck, Tim.
I need all the help I can get. And hopefully we're going to kind of work through this over the next 20 minutes or so.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, Jay, real quick, since we were talking about outside looking in before the trade went down. I mean, you have no stake in this covering the Celtics now. You're the Kyrie alum that I recently just joined in the group. Let me know when
proud
I get
graduates added. Graduates of the Kyrie School of Education.
I just put myself requested the Facebook group. If you have admin power, then you can let me in. But where were you thinking about this from afar? I mean, where did you think he was going to go? I mean, were you obviously you're covering your own team right now, but were you even working this at all, or out of curiosity, just checking in with people to see what it might be, and what was your reaction with Dallas?
I was surprised by Dallas because I thought it would be the most desperate team. And to me, the most desperate team was the Lakers. I guess from some level, I didn't realize how urgent the Mavericks were to find Luka a second star, because this really is like, it's a huge gamble. It's a gamble on someone who has never been able to stay happy no matter how good things are going. Who has never been able to stay happy when he's with his best friend, Kevin Durant, when he's with a championship caliber team in the Cavaliers, when he has a ton of talent around him in Boston. Like, he's been in great situations his whole career and is still always wanted out. And so it's just a huge gamble to me. So I was surprised by the Mavericks, but like anyone else, now I'm just fascinated to see what comes next, because he's truly like one of the most mesmerizing talents ever. And as you know, Schiffer, covering him on a night-to-night basis, the guy just does stuff so smoothly and just ridiculously. And it's just like incredible to watch him play. And Tim, you'll see that. Like, the highlights are one thing, but it's just like the way he does it every single night is just ridiculous. And not every single night, because he hasn't played a lot over the last few years, and that's one of the issues. But like, he's just an incredible, incredible talent. And that's why teams keep selling themselves on him. But yeah, I was and I think, I mean, from a Celtics writer perspective, all the people that we talk to in the organization, like everyone's interested in it because it's Kyrie. He's a lightning rod. And now
so
Tim,
Jay,
Tim gets when to deal Kyrie, with the lightning rod.
So when Kyrie he comes to Boston and he professes, you know, like his longstanding, you know, love, this is his new home. We as media members have to have a bullshit reader. And we're constantly trying, you know, like that's what press conferences are. Like you're trying to read through these cliches and, you know, these very tired concepts and ideas and kind of read behind what they actually mean or where they actually might be coming from. Like this is a huge part of our job. Did you get that sense or when did you get that sense with Kyrie that, you know, or maybe that was genuine to start? I guess I'm asking in the context of like, how should I be understanding the context of whatever he says about Dallas here, you know, later this week? This is publishing Thursday, so probably his initial comments as Dallas Mavericks will be out. But, you know, it's when they happen, what should my reaction be?
Yeah, so I do think he was genuine in that moment. That day, it was funny because I actually, so it was during some event at TD Garden where they basically just have had players. It's like a preseason event where they do like a 3-point shootout, like just stupid stuff for season ticket holders. And he actually, all the players spoke to the media beforehand. And so I had a men's league game. So I was like, media availability is over. I left. And so I was not there the moment Kyrie professed to the crowd at TD Garden that he was going to stay with the Celtics forever. But I do think in that moment it was genuine. And that first year he was with the Celtics, he was great. He was great to the media. He was great as a teammate. He was on the same page with everybody. And that year, if you can remember, it was Gordon Hayward got hurt 5 minutes into the season and nobody really expected much of the Celtics. Then they ripped off 16 straight wins like a second later. And then even after Kyrie got hurt, went to the Eastern Conference Finals, who knows what would have happened if he had stayed healthy. So he came back the next year. I do think that was totally genuine. But he can change his mind quickly. And he certainly didn't stay happy for too much longer. It didn't take long to realize that he was starting to, and the whole situation was messy. It wasn't just his part in it. Like Hayward was coming back from injury and he wasn't good yet, but they had to play him minutes to get him back up to speed. Terry Rozier had started during the playoff run and been very good. Now he's being asked to come off the bench in a contract year, so he's pissed off. I think they had Tatum and Brown were like obviously great talents, and they were starting, and but they had just had the run where they went to the finals, and now they're coming back, and Kyrie steps above them in the pecking order. So it was just a lot for everyone to deal with, and I think they probably had like 7 or 8 guys on that team who thought they were the second best player, which is never good. And then obviously Kyrie was the first best player, but it didn't take long to see him become unhappy, and then once he became unhappy, it was like the way I put it. Is he could have been a driving force to bring that team together. Like he's that type of powerful person. He has that much cachet, especially the young guys. Like they really looked up to Kyrie. Like he was one of the guys that they looked at in the league. Like, wow, he's incredible. And he never did that. He was divisive. He called out the young players on a regular basis, pissed them off. It's hard to like cover sometimes when a guy goes into a shell like that, and you can see how unhappy he is, how unhappy everyone is around him. I'll never forget the day before Game 5 of the Milwaukee series, and they're down 3-1, and at that point, like it's in Milwaukee, they're probably not gonna win. Like the odds are very much against them, but he shows up to shoot around and was just absolutely miserable. And Marcus Morris was over like 20 feet away. He's saying like, we're not dead. We can still do this, yada, yada, yada. And Kyrie was miserable. And And I remember looking at him like, they're done, like totally done. There's no way this guy is going to be able to have a good game tonight. He is totally not invested in this. And Al Horford, I have no idea what Al Horford was talking about with Kyrie, but he pulled him aside and talked to him for a while. And I would imagine he was trying to get, you know, to pump up Kyrie, motivate him a little bit. But it was stuff like that. Like some days he was just not happy. And the effect that had on the team because of who he is was very, very, very divisive. And I think that's why, you know, people in Boston look back at it so with, in like cases of fans, like animosity, is because he reached a point where it didn't seem like he was invested in it anymore. And I think he's probably reached that in other places too. But yeah, when he's on, man, and there were stretches when he was on, there were stretches when he came in and was awesome. But it never really stuck.
Is that hot and cold nature something that will extend to, you know, the avenues of my job, of press conferences, of how he interacts with media members? Are there times where, you know, he is going to give you the best quotes and he's going to look you in the eye and he's going to be like, whatever you need? And in other times that he's going to be the opposite of that. And certainly I want Schiffer's opinion here too, but yeah, what's your impression of him as a star to cover?
He was the toughest player I've ever had to cover. From the standpoint of like, if you don't word a question the right way, he might like just not really answer it. There was one time he tried to throw us out of the locker room pregame with like 10 or 15 minutes left in media availability, just because, you know, he didn't want us standing there. There was another time he yelled at this young woman. She must have been like 22 or 23. It was probably her first job. She was the camera woman. And so her job is to take footage of the players in the locker room. And he was dressed like it wasn't. And he started barking at her, like mad that she was taking footage of him. And then she said, I'm sorry. Like she was so sweet about it. She's like, I'm sorry. I can change the angle if you think like whatever. And then he just kind of yelled at her again. How much should I share? I guess I'll share it all. Why not? there was one time in Chicago, and I don't know if people really care about media stories too much, but they got bludgeoned in Chicago, like absolutely killed by a Bulls team. I don't think they were that good at the time, if I'm remembering correctly. And someone asked him if he was worried about the way their season was going, and he said, no, we'll be fine in the playoffs. Someone asked him why. He said, because I'm here. And so after that, Jackie McMullen was there. Jackie's like the legend.
The GOAT.
Absolute legend. The most respected media member in history. And she's just kind of joking with Kyrie. And she said, Kyrie, she's like half joking. She's like, I don't really buy it. Like just kind of a lighthearted moment. And he said, I don't give a fuck, and turned around and spun off. And so stuff like that you'll have to deal with now, Tim. And it's, but also like, and I told Schiffer this when he showed up to Brooklyn, he's like the guy, like Billy Madison and his friends, like he will drop a flaming bag of shit on your doorstep every day. And it'll be like this incredible gold content, sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes really interesting. And it's just like fascinating content. He's one of the most, like there's never a dull moment around Kyrie Irving.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like I can't really match some of Jay's stories. You have to remember with me, it's been a different type of media access every year since I started covering the team because of COVID. When Kyrie first came to Brooklyn, you know, he talked about his failed leadership in Boston and how I think the death of his grandfather, you know, affected him towards the end of his stint there. And, you know, for a while to start, he was pretty good to deal with from a, a access perspective. You know, it's not like he was giving one-on-ones or anything early on, but I remember speaking to Jack McMullen, like her ESPN story that fall of 2019, that the Nets were already kind of worried about him, which has aged terrifically. You know, I remember he was classified as moody, and like two or three games into his stint, he's already answering questions about his behavior and how he can kind of shut off a bit. And I remember him kind of like saying pretty directly, this is during post-game locker room scrums back in the day, you know, I'm proud of who I am. And, you know, he was playing terrific. He had 50 in his first game. And then, you know, he injured his shoulder on a layup against the Pelicans. And then it kind of got weird where he just stopped being in the lineup. I remember his last game was in mid-November in Denver, because that was Amon Shumpert's first game, because he came in as a I'm trying to remember who they signed a 10-day for with him. But for a while, we just heard nothing on Kyrie. You know, Kenny Atkinson, who was the coach at the time, didn't have much to say on it. You know, it's kind of now been revealed he was looking at multiple doctors and not exactly solely listening to the Nets medical staff. He was seeking his own opinions. I think there was something that he was like out in Arizona for one of them. Then, you know, he gets a cortisone shot. He comes back in January that year. And a couple things happened in that stretch. One of my first one-on-one dealings with him, you know, I'm from New Jersey. Kyrie's from New Jersey. You know, we're 3 years apart. We have a lot of mutual acquaintances, I guess I would say. You know, his high school's, you know, a straight shot up on the highway from where I live. And, you know, like Jay did a St. Pat's story on him. You know, for those of you who don't know, St. Pat's, you know, was and still kind of is a, now known as the Patrick School, NBA powerhouse. Al Harrington went there. Jonathan Kuminga on the Warriors. Kyrie, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. You know, I had heard he was helping out at practices while injured with the Nets. And so, again, you know, I know a lot of, you know, St. Pat's played against my high school. And I went up there for a story on what Kyrie does helping these kids at practice. And I wasn't really expecting him to be there. I was expecting to get, you know, kind of like a right around type deal, just going, given he was hurt. And the high school coach says to me, you know, I'm waiting outside in the lobby of this place. And he goes, like, where are you? I was like, I'm outside the lobby. He goes, Kyrie's talking to the team. Get in here. And, you know, I kind of try to slowly enter the room and everything. And, of course, the door makes this loud creak and everyone's looking at me. He's like, Kyrie looks at me. He's like, hello, what's going on? Take a seat. And, you know, he was great to me that night. You know, I watched the whole practice. His dad and godfather Rod Strickland were there. And, you know, I it's funny, you know, people talk about it sometimes, you know, when you get these exclusive, you know, what goes through your head. And, you know, I was nervous when I saw that he was there, just because it's like there was all this mystery about his shoulder. Like, is he going to yell at me? Like, what are you doing here? Like, I'm almost like the paparazzi. And, you know, he couldn't be more accommodating. He pulled me out in the hallway to make sure I got, you know, it was quiet when I talked to him about the whole thing. You know, he thanked me later that day for it. And, you know, the whole time going through my eyes, I'm watching him run the practice, is like, you know, I have 2 hours with Kyrie Irving all by myself, and it's my first year on the beat. You know, hopefully he doesn't think I'm here for his shoulder, and, you know, hopefully I don't screw this up. And, you know, it was, you know, him and I had a good rapport for a while after that. We would talk Jersey basketball. And, you know, even during some of the tougher times of his life, I mean, the death of Kobe obviously happened when the Nets were at Madison Square Garden. He wasn't there that day, but then, you know, he has that 50-point game coming back. He sprains his knee, which ultimately ended his first season a couple days later. And I remember him walking across the locker room on crutches to talk to us when he didn't have to. So, you know, his first year, he was very accommodating, all things considered, even though he only played 20 games. And then COVID happened, the NBA bubble and his role and all that happened. And, you know, before his second season with the Nets, we all got that email from his publicist, you know, a note from Kyrie Irving was the subject, and that he wasn't going to be talking to us that year when we didn't even do anything. And that's, I believe, when he tweeted that he called us pawns. And that, you know, the relationship with the, and like, we only covered him 20 games. It's not like we did anything to him. I mean, he played great those 20 games. I don't remember the record off the top of my head. I think it was closer to 500 than a winning one. But after that, I mean, it was never really the same with the local media, because then there was the vaccine mandate. You know, he had that 50-40-90 season that second year in Brooklyn. He was the most reliable of him, KD, and James Harden. You know, if he doesn't land on Giannis and sprain his ankle in that playoff series against the Bucks, I think they were winning the whole thing, maybe even without James Harden. But, you know, then the vaccine mandate stuff came up. He obviously refused to comply with it. And I mean, it, you know, from there on, it was always a bit contentious. He would still be decent at times and respectful, and, you know, still you can make some small talk with him. But, you know, really, ever since that second part of that second season, when the note from him came, that email, and also, you know, that time where he just didn't show up to the arena, and he had that, you know, he was later found to be at a birthday party and all that. You know, it's interesting. That was all over Zoom access, but you could just kind of tell, like, Steve Nash was having his first, you know, Kyrie experience where, like, he just had no idea what was going on, had no idea what to say. And that was an interesting dynamic in the locker room, too, because, you know, the whole team, you know, Kevin and Kyrie are like the leaders, but no one really knew what was going on. And it was just this weird deal of, like, you know, do you say something? Do you not say something? Talking to guys and you know, no one really even knows what was going on, let alone a comment on it. And that was, again, when there was no open locker room or anything. So definitely that second season, kind of like what Jay was saying, where the first one was relatively smooth riding, all things considered, just, you know, it changed after that. And it's kind of tie a bow on. I mean, I saw Jay last week when the Nets were in Boston. You talk about his unhappiness, the way he talked about the Celtics after that blowout loss. I don't even remember what the score differential was, Jay, but it, you know,
139-96.
Yeah, it was over 3 minutes in. You know, he'd been complimentary of the Celtics before. He had talked about, I've known these guys since they were pups. This doesn't surprise me what they're doing. But he essentially said, you know, it's clear as day to me that the Celtics have their eye on the title and they're not messing around in the regular season. And tonight we were just a team that got in the way. You know, we were all kind of debating how he sounded after that. Because as you talked about the bullshit meter, Tim, you know, I think we all just kind of, you know, our senses are what they are. And you kind of are around the guy enough to where you can kind of tell when something, you know, they're saying something that they usually don't say. You know, him talking about the Celtics, it was almost like wistful. Like he was kind of envious of what they had going on compared to the Nets, where he has to pilot the ship until Kevin's back. And here's this team that he left that's just rolling over teams left and right and not messing around. So that when the trade request came in Friday, my first thought was thinking about his comments Wednesday and how he almost kind of seemed like envious of the situation that he left to be in now.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23 for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There's a word that I think summarizes a lot of what you both have just said now, and it's a word that sports writers love to use. Alex and Jay, be honest. Have you ever described Kyrie Irving as a mercurial point guard?
I don't think I've ever said that word in my life, but same. But he would certainly qualify.
It's so weird. It's an adjective that gets attached to point guard specifically. I swear I've seen it to use, you know, Rajon Rondo was probably the first one who got it a lot.
Mercurial point guard.
Yes, he was for very sure. Mercurial. This might be the first time I've ever said it out loud as well, but I have absolutely written it. And, you know, I think that the way to summarize Kyrie is that he is prone to unpredictable and sudden shifts of mood or temperament. And, you know, he is always genuinely himself to a fault, I think it's fair to say. I'm very interested to see what the Kyrie experience is like here in Dallas. Like you guys, I do expect that the first season will be rather smooth. And the real question for Kyrie and his relationship with Dallas and his relationship to media members in Dallas will begin if and when, you know, let's say if. There's no when that I have or plan to report in the coming days, even if there is an expectation that the Mavericks are planning to do it. But, you know, if he resigns with the Mavericks this summer. I want to focus on, or I want to ask briefly about one very specific thing you said a while back, Jay. And you were talking about how if you didn't ask questions the right way, that he wouldn't give you an answer. And this is a really funny thing, and we don't have to go this far inside, you know, media and spend 5 minutes on it. But I'm curious, are there specific types of questions? Are there ways to ask Kyrie Irving a question that's going to get a better response? Or is it just about whether he wants to answer it?
It would be sometimes, maybe I was misreading it sometimes. And before I go on, like, I feel like I'm bashing the guy. And I genuinely think that there aren't people in Boston who think he's like an asshole. Like,
I would agree, in Brooklyn too.
People don't think he's an asshole. They think he's like a decent guy who he's done a ton good. Like, the work he's done with his old high school is incredible. He's donated millions of dollars. He's basically kept the entire school afloat by himself.
Pays for half the kids' tuitions, last I had asked. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this, the stuff that he's done is incredible. And it wasn't like he was coming in and doing like being bad to his teammates, like just being disrespectful to his teammates. I just think they didn't know how he was going to act on any given day. And over the course of time, that has a cumulative effect where people are kind of walking on eggshells. And I just think it all started with his unhappiness. And it's sad, honestly. To some extent, it's sad. Like, you feel for a guy who has what he has and has played with the teammates he's played with and has never been able to find like satisfaction, you know, like that, that really is, when you think about it, heart-wrenching in a way. So I don't want to feel like I'm piling on the guy, sharing like the worst stories from his time. And like sometimes he was totally fine to deal with. I sat down with him about his high school and we talked for 30 minutes and he was awesome. And there were times when he'd sit there after a bad loss and answer every single question. He was always available. Like, at least in that time, he was always giving interviews. He never missed media availability. Like, if we requested him, he was going to do it. But with the question thing, it was like, sometimes you could offend him if he thought you were like looking for one type of answer. It's pathetic, but I would like think for a lot of time about how I was going to phrase the question so that he would, and sometimes I would butter him up. I'd be like, you know what, Kyrie, like, you've played for championship teams. You've played at that level, like, and then get into the question part of it. And sometimes that worked, sometimes it didn't, but he's the only player where I've had to put that much thought into like how I'm going to phrase a question, because if I don't, then he might just dismiss the idea entirely and not give me even like a cliche answer.
And it is a common thing in sports writing. You know, there are cliche ways to phrase questions that there's an understanding what is being asked and what is being expected from the answer. And I try to avoid those as much as I can. But if you go to any press conference, you're going to hear those. But if you were to answer those questions literally, and occasionally players will, yeah, you know, how do you feel about the loss tonight? You know, it's supposed to be more like, how does this loss impact, you know, this point of the season for you guys? And, you know, is it frustrating? Is it, you know, exciting? You know, whatever it is. But, you know, it's kind of a shorthand parlance that I think is probably a little too common, but you know, could be answered literally. Schiffer, same for you. You know, just in terms of asking Kyrie questions, what's that like? Or what was that like for you?
Yeah, you know, just to throw in with Jay real quick, you know, I think Kyrie's got some Robin Hood to him where you talk about the charity events. Like the Nets would get texts about, you know, the lives he would change from his donations and whatnot, and he just didn't want to put it out there and would rather keep it to himself. And, you know, we're talking about his image and whatnot. I mean, in a way, you got to respect him for the way he's kind of kept that stuff to himself instead of, you know, put it out there of look all the good I'm doing. I do think that there's a debate there as to, you know, how some of that stuff maybe could have helped him over the years, given some of the water he's found himself in. You know, in terms of the question, it's been interesting. Like, I do think he's got some personality. I mean, you know, a couple weeks ago when they were kind of in this rut where, you know, every game would kind of go the same, where they had a hot start, second quarter, third quarter, when Kevin and or Kyrie would hit the bench, other team gets back in the game, then the game kind of came down to who wins the fourth quarter. You know, I mentioned the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. I was like, you know, Kyrie, every game lately seems like it's been Groundhog Day. And he's like, Groundhog Day? He's like, what's that? And I was like, the movie. And he goes like this. He's like right over my head. And, you know, then like he took another question. He comes back to me. He's like, how old are you? I was like, I'm 27. And he's like, that's right. We're same generation. He's like, Groundhog Day. I haven't seen it. So, you know, I think, you know, with the question stuff with him, it was interesting because, you know, like the vaccine stuff, you know, you would ask him like, do you feel guilty at home, you know, watching your team play and struggle without you? And, you know, he would make it personal, like, don't get your emotions involved in this, when it's like, no, I think, you know, I would argue that's a fair question of like, you're ineligible for this game because of a decision you made, but your team is kind of facing the consequences of it. Right. And so he would get very defensive with some of those things, very, very quickly. And, you know, even this year with the documentary stuff, the anti-Semitic documentary, you know, he, that press conference, that the first one where it got really hot, I'll remember the rest of my life, because Megan Triplett, the Yes Network sideline reporter, you know, asked him about it, you know, the backlash. And, you know, usually the regional sports networks, obviously, you know, those guys kind of know, you know, because they cover the team's games, you know, it's going to be, you know, they're not going to be as hard or whatever, you know. And he was starting to give her attitude. He's like, you know, what backlash? And that's when I kind of knew it was going to get ugly. And, you know, you see him blowing up and saying, you know, I can't be anti-Semitic. And he had the second press conference where he doubled down on it. And it you know, he was doing this thing where he would give these really long answers and you just couldn't really understand what he was getting at. And he wasn't directly answering the question, which obviously, you know, if you're asking him to denounce anti-Semitism, it's kind of a straightforward, not run-of-the-mill type thing. You know what I mean? It's either you do or you don't. And so I think a lot, you know, he played hardball for unnecessary reasons, I feel like. And it just kind of seemed like no matter how you phrase it, because like Jay, you know, some people go to bed counting sheep. I kind of fell asleep at times this year trying to figure out better ways to ask questions during this whole thing, because these aren't subjects they necessarily teach you about in journalism school with how to handle. There's no book on it. And it just seemed like, you know, each time that, you know, those two press conferences he had, and, you know, everything, asking the other guys about it in the moment, you know, it was so difficult because you were trying to ask in a genuine way. But, you know, acknowledging Kyrie's headstrongness was also kind of a thing where, you know, it do the guys know where you're coming from? You know, you're trying to acknowledge this was a thing, but not necessarily put it, associate them with it. You know, it was this weird dance for a while just because, you know, again, it's an uncomfortable conversation for all of us, right? And you know, he made it harder than it had to be with the way he was kind of talking around the stuff, and not, you know, he was asked if he believes the Holocaust happened, and he didn't give a straight answer, and it was just this weird dance of like, you know, we're asking you direct stuff, but you're giving us all these answers that we just can't really process in the moment, you know. And to go back on something, you know, this is a long time ago, but he had that comment in January 2020 where after a loss, you know, he talked about the Nets roster and how glaring it was compared to the rest of the contenders. And like in the moment, we didn't really think anything of it. And then as we're all transcribing in the Philadelphia media room at Wells Fargo Center, it all hit us like, oh, wait a minute. This is what he's saying. He's naming half these guys that shouldn't, you know, that it sounds like in his opinion shouldn't be on the team anymore or won't be going forward. And so there was definitely times where you just couldn't really figure out what he was meaning in the moment. Then afterwards it would hit you of like, oh, wait a minute. So I definitely think that there was a listening component to all this that you just couldn't really accelerate no matter how much you wanted to. Because as you said, you know, these press conferences, right, we're all thinking on our feet. I've kind of compared it to like a fantasy football draft queue where you have, you know, you could stash a player away for who you want taken later round. And if it's gone, you know, you might have three questions in your head. If those are the three questions before you get the mic, it's like, wait, what am I asking? And so with him, I just think it would be difficult at times because you're like, you're still processing what he said two answers ago for your own question. You're like, wait, what? So I think that there was definitely some just unnecessary handling of some of it on his end where he could have been more direct and clean a lot of this up and there would be less controversy than there was.
Yeah, he never, ever ended a controversy. Like, even in Boston, it was like the video came out of him and Durant at All-Star Weekend, and instead of just saying we weren't talking about that, it was like he said a whole bunch of really stuff that wasn't really meaningful, and it just did not diffuse the situation whatsoever. Same thing when they had a press conference. Like, he's very bad at diffusing a situation. And maybe he doesn't want to diffuse a situation. Maybe he wants to pour flames on, or pour gasoline on all the flames always. But he never makes things easy on himself. And listen, most of this stuff does not matter to a basketball team. Like, there have been people, there have been players that are difficult to deal with, that are great teammates, that are awesome teammates, that show up every day and help their team and do what the coach wants them to do and are reliable from that perspective all the time. And so none of this stuff that, I mean, the anti-Semitic stuff ended up mattering on the floor because, you know, he was suspended. And some of the comments he said about his teammates, I'm sure they look at him differently because of that. And so some of that stuff actually mattered. But for the most part, the way he deals with guys like us literally does not matter to the basketball team whatsoever. It's more so like, can the Mavericks get him to play a lot? Can they get him to manage everything in his life so that he is reliable on a daily basis? Because when he is, and we just saw it in Brooklyn, they went 18-2 in a 20-game stretch with him and Kevin Durant. And now he's playing with Luka Doncic, who is one of the few people on Earth who is in a similar caliber to Kevin Durant. And so as much as we say stuff about all this, I just want to make it clear, like, it, a lot of what we're talking about doesn't matter on the basketball court. But he still hasn't been reliable, and that's the stuff that's the reason why Brooklyn's, you know, 4 years or 3.5 years with him didn't go nearly as well as planned. It was part of the reason, I'm sure, why Kevin Durant wanted out. It was part of the reason we've heard why James Harden wanted out. And in Boston, like, he left and Al Horford ended up leaving in free agency. It took them years to get back to a level of talent that they were at that time. They still don't really have a level of talent as good as they are now. Like, that team was just loaded. And so he has left places in pretty bad situations. And honestly, like, from a perspective of, like, I just hope the guy finds happiness and yeah, is able to just enjoy what he has, because you can see, like, the stuff with the media, the stuff with a lot of like it's just a fight for him, is how I would put it. And in a lot of ways, like, he is a sympathetic figure who doesn't always deal with it well and sometimes deals with it really, really poorly. But there are ways that you definitely feel for the guy.
Yeah, I think everything we've talked about this on this podcast so far contributes to the journey that has led him now to Dallas and now that he's a player that I am covering. But Schiffer, you said earlier they don't teach in journalism school how to cover Kyrie Irving. There's not a book about it. There's now a podcast. And I appreciate y'all's perspective. I feel closer to start this interesting journey and story of Kyrie Irving Texan than I was before. So wish me luck. And to everybody else, thanks for listening. We'll see ya.
The NFL is unmatched. Elite athleticism. Weekly drama. Millions watching every game day. Billions of dollars in revenue. But among all that attention, money, and success, the league has a critical flaw.
In my experience, the NFL does have a race problem, but more than that, the owners have a race problem.
The people who make the hiring decisions, I don't think that they are going to look at two candidates and think the black candidate is clearly superior.
What you don't realize is that as you're going through all of that, the stress it puts on you, it's like somebody beating you down every day.
The thing is, it has to be player led. We call it the NFL, but the 32 owners, like, we can't sit here and say, like, this is important to all 32 of those guys.
Football teams hated it. You know, issues like the national anthem, kneeling for the national anthem, issues like players speaking out at protests.
Watching Roger Goodell, like, get on TV and, you know, try to sound like he with it. We know it. There's a definite limit on this allyship, right?
I wasn't a big fan of the NFL because of what I had to go through and the way it was. I looked up on it and I just felt like I was fed up with the NFL.
I'm Tashawn Reed, the host of a new podcast series from The Athletic called Between the Lines. The series details how America's biggest game has grappled with America's biggest issue. From the players who weigh the risks of being socially active in the wake of Colin Kaepernick, to coaches and executives vying for equal opportunities, to a league and owners who have failed to support and promote diversity. The series includes exclusive interviews from LaDainian Tomlinson, Doug Williams, Jason Wright, and several more players, coaches, and front office executives across the game. Look for Between the Lines starting on February 14th on The Athletic Football Show every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.